Thank you very much. I'm going to be focusing on today, the thematic focus of my presentation is on the independent academic publishing being no longer a pioneer's path. As the saying goes, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and many of the things I'm going to be discussing are indeed not new in terms of traditional publishing, but even independent publishing has progressed tremendously over the course of the last few years, so some of these things might not be so new even in independent publishing, but I hope to have a few surprises, a few things that I can also show you that are new in independent publishing. A little bit of background about who I am and what I've done to put things in context. I worked for 18 years as an executive director of 8 learned societies with our offices in The Hague, and we were active in 130 different countries. And one of my responsibilities was for the publishing program of these learned societies. And in the course of those 18 years, we had tremendous difficulties working with traditional publishers. Why? Because of the price points. I would get letters from a traditional publisher saying, "Congratulations, Mr. Burzee, we're limiting price increases this year to 18%. Fantastic, when inflation is at 1%. Or they would bundle content in ways that our members would only want this journal or this book series, but we'd have to buy, you know, the whole caboodle, and we weren't happy in that process. So in the course of those 18 years, I was always trying to, you know, move publications around, book series to different publishers, try different experiences, try different models, but I was always dissatisfied with the ultimate results. And we had the most success in trying to link with other professional associations and try and do things independently. And I always thought in my mind, it'd be great if there'd be some independent publishing platform. I left the publishing world for a short time and went into the investment world. But then I came back to it because I heard that, oh, here's a very progressive publisher in England. And so I went back into traditional publishing and I got a peek behind the curtain. And I didn't like what I saw. I was very embarrassed, actually. I was in situations in which I would be requiring people to make buyback deals. Oh yeah, we'll publish your book, but you have to purchase 300 copies. And then, yeah, we'll sell lots of books. But when they processed a purchase of 300 copies, they've paid not only for our costs, but they've paid for our basic profit as well. So they were independently publishing without even knowing it. I had situations in which I was negotiating user contracts for research centers, and we were asked not to determine what are the costs and then figure a profit on top of that. We were asked to find out about the customer's ability to pay. You know, is it wealthy? Can we charge this much, that much? And this seemed very unethical to me, so I left that world again, and I was contacted by the CEO of a company called Lulu, which you're probably familiar with. It's a well-known independent publishing company, and it was founded by a guy by the name of Bob Young. And his story is interesting because he was a very successful entrepreneur, and he started a company called Red Hat that was very successful in Linux services. But when he finished, and he sold the company off, but he thought, I want to help younger people. So he wrote a book about his experiences, particularly persons who are involved in startups of dot-coms. And then he started contacting publishers to publish it. And he thought, what? Those are the royalties you're going to pay me? These are the costs? You're going to charge this price point? And then he thought, I'm going to start a new concept in publishing. And I'm going to start independent publishing. And so he started Lulu in 2002, which has published more than 2.2 million books since that time. One of the biggest misunderstandings in independent publishing is that we're publishers. We're not. We don't publish. You do. You own the content, and so you're responsible for the publishing. We provide the services and the facilities to facilitate you in publishing. So independent publishing has come a long way since inception, and no, I'm not going to go as far back to the 15,000 BC when we had the cave paintings, but in actual fact, none of us are here right now. We're all a figment of each other's imaginations, because in 2012, that was the end of the world, according to the Mayan calendar. So none of us are here. But if I was to take a look at what is responsible for the development of independent publishing, I would focus on several things. One, technology. The advances in technology, in particular in computing technology, has made it possible to provide what's necessary in terms of a publishing platform onto your own PCs, even your own mobile devices. This was impossible for maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, but now with the computing power that you have in your own hands, with the memory that you have, independent publishing is now realistically possible. Another major technological advancement is printing on demand. You might not be familiar with this concept, but traditionally printing involves what we call offset printing, which is very expensive, it's relatively slow, and it requires, in terms of economics, typically for publishers to print large amounts so that they're less expensive on a per unit basis. So they have to be printed large amounts, they have to be transported somewhere, and they have to be stored and insured, and when someone makes a purchasing order, one or 10 or 100 copies goes out, that has to be transported again to somewhere else. That's a very expensive process. Printing on demand, because of the technologies that have made this possible, means that you can just order one copy that is automatically created in the course of typically 24 hours. So when we get a requirement to print 100 books or one book, it doesn't really make a difference to us. There's no storage. It goes from the printer, and it's shipped immediately out. So we have an independent network of cloud-based print-on-demand companies that we're associated with. And it's geography agnostic. It doesn't care who's making the order. So if someone sees your book on the site and they say, okay, I want one copy of this educational textbook or whatever, and the person's processing the order from Sydney, Australia. Now in the old world, okay, they're all stored here in the United States, copy has to come out, or 10 copies have to come out, they have to be shipped all the way to the United States, all the way to Australia. That takes, you know, transport, air transport, it takes days to get there. It also involves a lot of costs in that process as well. With printing on demand, someone sees your book in any part of the world, and say Australia, immediately it's printed in our printer in Melbourne, and then within 24, 48 hours, it's sent to the customer, even though here in the United States, you created your order here. So it doesn't care. It just takes a look, where's the closest printer in the world? And so this has dramatically changed the whole concept of publishing and printing. It reduces costs. It wasn't possible even 4 or 5 years ago because of the quality of printing on demand wasn't as good as it is now. Now it's almost indistinguishable from offset printing. And indeed, we had recently in our book fair in London, we had a sample of several books, identical books that were printed in offset and printing on demand, and people could not tell the difference in quality between them. A printer, an experienced printer with a magnifying glass, would probably be able to tell, but essentially for the general user, it's not possible. So the technology has advanced tremendously. The economics have changed dramatically as well. Authors are responsible for the content. All the academics are responsible for creating the content. The academics are responsible for the quality control through peer review. So why aren't you getting your reasonable proportion of the royalties? We pay 70% of the royalties, and that tends to be typical in independent publishing, between 60% and 80%. You'll find comparing different ones. What are the royalties for a traditional publisher? Well, the average royalty is around 9%. It does differ between 6% and 14%, 15% sometimes, but that's quite a bit different than from the traditional publishing model. So the economics have changed, and also there's a movement in many countries to make educational products more affordable. If you take a look at the price of textbooks in the United States since 1978, they've gone up more than 1,000%. Compare that with the price index in that same time is about 240%. The cost of housing is about 400%. Cost of medical care is around 800%. But the cost of a textbook, according to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, more than 1,000%. That's ridiculous. We had one of our authors, he's actually the Vice Dean of Carnegie Mellon University, head of the physics department there. He was publishing with a traditional publisher, set the price of the book at $350. His students were furious. You know, they have all the things they have to pay for. I have to pay for a textbook at $350? And he didn't have control. He had to wait for 3 years until he could get control back of his textbook from a legal perspective. And then he published it with us. He set the price at $65, and he quadrupled his own profits. So the economics have changed dramatically. Also, even government policies have changed. A lot of funding agencies, and I know there's several here in the United States, in the UK, it's UK Research Council. In Europe, it's Horizon 2020 funding. Make it, for example, mandatory that if you receive government funding from us, that you have to publish what's called open access. I don't know if everyone's familiar with open access, but it means making your content freely available. So we'll pay your costs and we'll support your funding. We'll give you the money that you require, but then it has to be made available open access. Now, this has sort of changed the dynamic between publishers and the content creators, academics, because in the past, they had what I would call a sort of an external locus of control with the publishers, in that I'm responsible for the content creation, I will produce it, and then I'll hand it off to you, and that's my control stops there. You're responsible for adding value and for disseminating and for doing all the rest. Fair enough, but with this new open access model, and about 14% of all content, academic content, is now open access, what has happened is, okay, so I'll produce everything, and the academic community is responsible for its curation, for its quality control, but then I'm going to have to pay for it now as well. That doesn't seem right to me. So this sort of an internal locus of control. Things are moving back to the author saying, well, if I'm going to create it, if I'm responsible for the quality of control, and if I'm essentially the customer creating it, the economics have to change. Because, for example, an open access, the typical price, a book processing charge for a monograph in traditional publishing is $14,500. Well, within traditional publishing, you can do it independently. It depends. If you need peer review and everything, then it will cost about $2,000. That's a fraction of the cost. So this has also helped change the perceptions of traditional publishing. And we'll get into this a little bit later, the control dynamics have altered considerably. And there's a lot of geopolitical events that have taken place as well. For example, in the UK, we have Brexit. And there's sort of a rise of populism taking place in many countries in the world, which has sort of resulted in restrictions or cuts to education funding. I just heard when I was in the UK that the government will be introducing 7% reductions in education, and it has already resulted in layoffs. Actually, when I was taking the drive over here from Boston, I was listening on the car, and they said, well, they're providing professors in Boston University for $20,000 with the ability to stop. Universities are having difficulty. They have to cut costs. So one of the things they're looking at, hey, maybe we should get into independent publishing as well. And we have actually a lineup of universities that want to start up their own independent publishing platform using our software. So this is, I believe, a potential direction. We'll be launching in 2 weeks what we call an independent print API, so universities can print using our software independently using this print-on-demand model. And many of the universities, even in the United States, you go to the site, people are processing orders on their site, but it's actually us that are doing it on a white-label basis. So we're more prevalent, and the technology that we incorporate is used already by many universities. So I've explained a little bit about what Glasstree is. We started in 6 months ago, in 2016. We've already published more than 200 books. And we started because we looked at our mother company, Lulu, and we discovered that about 38% of our content is already academic or scholarly content. But people wanted certain products and services that were finely attuned to the academic. For example, a brand. It's very important to be associated not to be associated with a non-academic brand. People don't want their book on particle physics to sell beside a book on why I married a vampire. So we gave them a specific brand that's focused towards academics. And we gave them many other things, and I'll be discussing them in the course of this presentation, that would help satisfy and make academic authors successful. Now, we realize that, you know, there's different users, different needs. Even in the pre-university, we have a brand called Lulu Junior that helps young children to create books. And the reason being, we've seen a lot of progress. There's been a lot of research showing that young people in the K-12 age bracket have too much passive education. It's all passive. Reading, listening to the teachers, all passive. They need more active education, writing, constructing their ideas, organizing their thoughts, and putting them on paper. Research has shown that young people who do this actually perform better, their marks are better in later life. So the ability to create content, to see this marriage between form and content at a very young age can be very beneficial. So we've had a lot of success with, you know, young students creating their content in class and seeing a physical product come back to them published at a very low price and then showing them off and, oh, Timmy, you made spelling mistakes on page 6. Oh yeah. So it really changes the way that they think about content and helps to improve their education. And of course, undergraduates have other needs as well. They're interested in their thesis and dissertation. And in the past, from the publishing world, there wasn't too much interest in thesis and dissertation, but there is a lot now. A lot of publishers are actually engaging with very young academics and saying, well, can you show us your research? And so we're engaging with these. I'll be speaking at the U.S. Thesis, Electronic Thesis and Dissertation Conference in Washington this year. They invited me because one thing that these young people do not have is platforms to get their content seen and to have some certain benefits attached to their content, which we'll discuss a little bit later. And of course, graduate students, faculty, they're interested in biometrics. They're interested in, as we know the saying, publish or perish. It's very important to be recognized in the academic community as a result of your work. We conducted a survey 3 months ago of academics, an international survey of 30,000 academics. And we were surprised to see some of the responses were not surprising at all, and some were incredibly surprising. As an example of what's not surprising, we were looking and we asked people, why do you publish? What's important to you? What's your motivation for publishing? And those things were things like peer recognition. There's nothing new there. That's a given. That was always important. But they indicated that what's also very important is availability, that their works be available in multiple sites. They also indicated, interestingly enough, that 80% were not happy with publishing in the way it was. 65% said they wanted more control of their content. And so we asked them why they weren't happy, and the two things that came up constantly was speed and money, speed and economics. Now, speed, I was talking to one of our authors who indicated to me that, you know, his publisher contacted him and said he had plans to launch a textbook, and or it's actually a monograph. And they said, okay, you've got 6 months, according to the contract, we want this in by 6 months. He said, 6 months, you had to cancel his a cruise he had planned, there was summer vacation, he worked diligently, and he did it. He got it in its final form, and then it took his publisher 13 months to publish it with no essential major changes. So speed is very important to them, and having that control. I have a horror story from another author that we had. He actually published with the traditional publisher, and it was a book with, I guess, based on engineering, and he used as an example the Twin Towers. This was published 2 months before 9/11, and then when the terrible event happened in 9/11, he told his publisher, you have to take this book down. The way I wrote it is now offensive, and I'm getting hate letters, this is just absolutely terrible. His publisher told him, you know, we've printed 10,000 copies, we're not taking it down. So for 3 years, he suffered indignant criticisms, attacks, until it came to the point where he bought all the remaining copies just to take it down. So he had no control of the ownership. Now there's two very important concepts that I'd like to emphasize during this presentation. One you'll be very familiar with because it's been important in the past, it's important now, and it'll be important in the future. And the other one you might not be so familiar with, and that is discoverability. The volume of content that's being published today is incredible. So you could say, I just worked very hard to publish my book, and there it is. World, come grab it. Your book is a needle in the haystack. So it's very important for you to focus on how can I facilitate the discoverability of my book, or my book series or my journal. And this is something that we thought about in great detail in Glasstree when we conceived it and when we launched it. Some things you can do yourself to help facilitate discovery. For example, creating as much information to inform the purchaser. And we had a guy who launched the physics book, and he said, you know, second grade physics textbook. That was it. If you were investing in, I don't know, $90, and would you buy something based only on the fact that it's second grade physics, second year physics textbook? I wouldn't. So you have to provide information to allow the author or to allow the user to make an informed decision to purchase your book. And that includes things like including detailed keywords, including table of contents, providing perhaps even a free page or several pages or a free chapter so that they can gauge the relevance of your work and the quality of your work in order to make an informed decision whether to purchase or not. And discoverability is also extremely important in terms of three big letters, SEO, search engines, optimization. You're giving me a course today, search engine optimization. And so we've done a lot of things to facilitate search engine optimization. For example, we built into this a taxonomy that we were given permission to use from the National Academy of Sciences so that to help facilitate the discovery of your work. This is a nested three-tier taxonomy so that people can find work. People can identify specifically the sub taxonomies that they're looking for and find your work much easier. We had in the past, I heard a story from someone in Texas saying that, oh, he heard a recommendation of a really good algebra textbook, but he didn't know about the author. Now he went into our former site, on Lulu Publishing, and he typed in, you know, algebra textbook. Yeah, he got hundreds of options. He wasn't able to find it. So, you know, within this nested taxonomy, it's much easier to find it. But we've gone much further in order to facilitate SEO. We've created relationships with some of these organizations, some you might be familiar with, some not. Clarivate, which is formerly Thomson Reuters, we've provided our content to them and so that the libraries with which they have subscriptions, and this is also equally relevant with Scopus, they can see the new thing, as the books are published, they can see, oh, this is this new content. Is this relevant for my university? Should I process a purchase of this or not? What's really exciting is a lot of the SEO, these new relationships that we have with TrendMD and YouKnow. We just started these a month ago, and TrendMD is actually a widget built into our site that's constantly searching what content is there. And then when the TrendMD users and universities are looking for content, they can say, here's a relevant search. And then it will bring the interested user to our site so that they can process a purchase of the book. And YouKnow is something similar, incorporating very advanced search engine optimization and artificial intelligence that triangulates the subject matter relevance for someone who's looking. So maybe I'm looking on something on health sciences. Yeah, that's very vague. And the artificial intelligence will search for relevant options, and then say, well, what about use of nicotine? Then it will bring more finite results. But what about, nicotine use in single mothers? Okay, and then more information, single mothers in Alabama. And it will really help to pinpoint the specific content that you're using. And then it provides them with a snippet, one or two paragraphs within your content. So they say, yeah, this is exactly what I want. This is exactly what I need. And so I'm going to process a purchase of this book on the site. The way people are searching and making purchasing decisions has changed dramatically over the years. In the past, people would say, oh, well, I'm only going to buy from publisher X or Y because I know that, you know, this is quality content. Again, we know that publishers, they don't create content. You do. The academics do. So what's important now is subject matter relevance and SEO and creating the links to get people to your content. That's absolutely essential. And the second item, which is not so new, and that's the big Q. Always been important, is important, always will be important. That's quality. Quality of content is absolutely essential, and that's what you determine. We can help you in this regard, and we have some services. For example, you might have heard of peer review. We have a peer review service, so if you want to get your content peer reviewed, and there's different types of peer review. You might have heard single blind, double blind, open review. That single blind or double blind refers to the fact that, for example, in double blind, the reviewer doesn't know who the author is and vice versa. So it's completely anonymous, and the objective being that this be a very objective review. Or single blind, in which only one of the persons is aware of the identity of the others. And you have open review that's facilitated as well, in which many persons are invited to provide a critical assessment of the content. And in the course of a peer review, you can get several decisions. They can say, this is great, this work as it stands is very credible from a scholarly standpoint, and it can be accepted. And we identify all the content, the authors indicate on our bookstore, what's peer review, what's not, and what type of peer review it is. Is it single blind, or is it double blind, or is it open peer review? It's not necessary to peer review all content. It's your decision as to whether or not you want this to get done. For example, theses and dissertations aren't peer-reviewed because in the process of working with their examiners, that is a process of sort of internal peer review. So the other decisions that are possible are revise or reject. And, you know, in the beginning of their careers, a lot of academics are very sensitive to this. But in actual fact, 80% of all contents that's submitted to peer review the first time around, only about 20% get accepted first time around. So it's not unusual at all to receive either a revise or reject. And the rejection doesn't necessarily mean that the content is poor, but it might not, for example, satisfy the aims and scope that are identified in the beginning of the book. So it needs work. This is an example of a service that helps to facilitate quality. And these days, quality is measured. It's not a subjective thing. And this is what we call bibliometrics. So if you can influence, for example, quality is often expressed in the word of impact. If you can influence the impact, the quality of your work, this will be measured by bibliometrics. So if you can do this, then we know there'll be positive results in terms of usage, who's using your book, who's processing a purchase, and ultimately sales. So we can't stress enough the importance of quality. And so bibliometrics, the measurement of quality, and I say long live the DROE. What in heaven's name is a DROE? Now that's an acronym for Digital Object Identifier. And this is something that is it's like a digital flag identifying you to be the author and the of that particular work. Now in the past, people would, for example, have their books for sale with a URL, and people would say, oh yeah, I might buy that, or I'll come back and buy that, I'll save that URL. But URLs move around. They're not static. A DOI is static. And in the past, they were only issued by traditional publishers. We have gotten permission to issue them on behalf of our authors, so that it shows who is the owner of this content, and it attaches the content, the book, metadata associated with this content, with the individual, and us as the organization that's bringing it on, and the behalf. And we had to sign legal contracts saying that we would maintain these in perpetuity. So these cannot change. And so if anyone wants to find your book, it's absolutely essential that they have this DOI. And so bibliometrics have used these DOIs to help measure the amount, for example, is your book being cited or not? If it's being cited, this can give rise to a bibliometric indicator called the impact factor. ISBN is not a measurement of quality. It indicates that you are the owner of this content. It's international series book number this number registers you as the owner of this content, but it's not an indicator of quality. But there's many different indicators of quality. Scopus has them. In the UK, they have the ABS. In Australia, they have the ABCD measurements. But they cannot function without this digital object identifier attaching these measurements to your book. They're often loved by deans because they can make schools can make purchasing decisions based upon these quality indicators. And it's even gone farther to the point where people will hire based upon these bibliometrics. They can see, oh, this person has, I'm not going to read all of their books or all of the articles. I have to make a decision on the quality of their content based upon their bibliometrics. And I can see they're at this level. And it's even gone farther to that individuals have bibliometric indicators. It's called an H index, saying, oh, you published this much content in a time period. So it measures the time, the volume of content you published in time, and the quality using those bibliometrics. As a result, you get an H index. So they can say, he or she has an H index of 22, and this one has an H index of 9. Maybe you should hire 22. Now, this isn't the only reason upon which they make a hiring decision, but it influences it. Yes, you have a question? Okay, you need both, because when you register, you want to say, okay, from a legal standpoint, I'm the owner of this content. Where the DOI is, this is how I find you and attribute bibliometrics to this specific book. But I guess the part I don't
understand is how... We're recording, so I'm going to ask you to use the microphone. No
problem. I'm trying to understand
sure.
this. I'm hearing this for the first time. Maybe some of my colleagues are hearing it for the
first
time.
Your questions are welcome.
I don't understand how this is measuring quality.
Oh, okay. Now, I'll give you an example then. For example, one of the measurements of quality, it's called altmetrics, and it's very common for books. What it does is measure the amount of action, social media interaction and discussion on a particular on a book. So, for example, you launch your book, and it's got a DOI, and you start doing some promotion on a social media, and people start talking about it. It measures this talk. And it doesn't measure the quality of the talk. Some people... Well, experience has shown those books in which there's a lot of discussion typically demonstrate higher quality than those books in which there's no discussion. Fair enough. But that's why there's many different bibliometric indicators. Now, one of them is the impact factor, and there's a lot of controversy about the impact factor. Not everyone is pleased with it. It measures the amount of citations. For example, say a book is cited 25 times compared to another book that's cited only one time. The citation might be negative, saying, oh, this is a really bad book. Negative citations tend to go like this, and then they die, because the community recognizes this isn't content of quality, it's not worth us pursuing, and then people don't mention it anymore. But when people cite a book of high quality, it's repeated and repeated for years and even decades. And that's why the impact factor can increase tremendously over time. So experience has shown that over time, repeated citations are indicators of quality. And yes, there is a controversy, and not everyone is happy, and that's why there's many different indicators have come out to try and capture and measure this quality, but there's no definitive measure. We have introduced something because we want to get your books discovered. We've introduced the ability for you to promote your books and give you some tools on social media. And so we've linked with this company called Kudos to do this. And I'd just like to play a short film about this to illustrate it. You had a question?
I have a question about the DOI. I understand from other presenters that you pay for your ISBN, yeah. You pay for your copyright. Do you also pay for the DOI?
When you publish with us, we give you free ISBN and free DOI. So it's nothing.
Thank you.
So we want to provide authors with the ability to promote their own work. No one knows your content better than you do, so to promote it independently. And we give you a dashboard so you can measure the results on altmetrics. So maybe you do a promotional thing and you see, registering. There's no traction in the community, so maybe I should change my messaging. Or if you see it is going... It is gaining a lot of attention, then you say, I must be doing something right. But I'll just play this here for you.
Introduction to Kudos. Congratulations on getting your article or book published. But now, who's going to read and cite it? With over a million new publications being added to the literature every year, it's getting harder for authors to ensure their work is found and read. Kudos can help. Kudos is a free service for the research community. We provide you with tools to ensure that your publications are seen by your peers and well beyond, helping your work have impact all over the world, in your own discipline, but also in allied fields too. With Kudos, you can explain and share links to your publications, then sit back and watch your readership grow. Using Kudos is easy. There are just three simple steps. Step 1, explain. Give your publication a short title and explain what it's about and why it is important. You can also add a more personal perspective and link related resources to your publication, such as videos, images, datasets, and blog entries, to show the broader context of your work. Kudos then makes these explanations of your work visible across the web, linking back to your publication to help more people find and understand your work. Step 2, share. Now you're ready to share.
With QDOS, you can post links to your publications by email, social media, academic networks, or on your blog or website. Now here's the exciting bit. Step 3, measure. With QDOS, you can then see the impact of this on your publication metrics, such as views, downloads, citations, and alt metrics. More impact for your work, more QDOS for you. Get started now by registering at www.growqdos.com.
Now, for everyone who publishes with us, with Glossary, we provide free QDOS use. But for anyone to use it, you have to have a DOI, that digital flagpole that can find your work. It's actually like a 13-digit number. Part of it identifies you as the author and your metadata and your work, your content, and us as the publisher. So again, an aspect of to demonstrate quality and to demonstrate discoverability is brand. As individual academics, you have to create your own brand. And the most successful authors have been very good at this. If you take a look at some of these people, you know, Stephen Hawking, is this going to be a book of good quality? I think so. And all of these persons, Mildred Drexelhaus, the queen of carbon sciences, Jane Goodall, an anthropologist, James Watson and Francis Crick in the DNA, have been very successful in building a brand over time and as a result have sold a lot of books. But you know, even without being on this level, you can be very successful in, you know, creating a website, linking that website to your QDOS page, linking that website to, you know, other relevant pages, to build a brand with your picture, get your identity known, get your work, your content, so that people identify you with your subject area. Oh, this is the, you know, the expert in this string theory or whatever. Building your brand is absolutely essential. To facilitate quality, we have made available many different types of publishing services. And I don't have a great deal of time to discuss these, but we've got editorial services, publicity and marketing services, creative services, and various other publishing services like project management, rights and permissions, project management. Maybe you have the funding and you have the content, but you don't have the time and you want someone to do this on your behalf. Or rights and permissions, you don't know if you're legally entitled to use the graphics that you found or the images that you found. Editorial services, things like copy editing, proofreading, indexing, publicity. You know, we have a PR firm that can launch your book in 4 different countries at the same time. Or if you want a social media blitz, we can do this on your behalf. These are paid for services, and so they do require an investment on your part. Some of them, it's surprising how moderately priced they are. I think our PR package is started around $600. And creative services, if you need illustrations, design. And these are incorporated in a complementary brand called Glass Leaf. So Glass Leaf and Glass Tree. So it's very important to put you in the middle of control. All these things that happen from, you know, writing, then editing, proofreading, design, creating the physical copy, using printing on demand, and then I'll talk a little bit later about distribution, social media promotion, and getting your book to the market. So it's you, you're the publisher, and you have control of these things. We have just, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to launch a major distribution agreement with one of the largest distribution companies going, which will put all our books in 1,200 universities, and it will make them available on the well-known retail outlets, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So control, I use this Greek myth, sailing between Scylla and Charybdis, giving you the ability to fine-tune the control. So yeah, you can take years and years to have excellent quality, but then you'll be publishing, you know, after everyone else has, or you can do it very quickly and you have poor control. We think we can give you the tools and services to find a balance between those two. There's different types of access. I mentioned briefly open access, which is starting to take off. About 14% of content is open access. The rest is closed access. Licensing is very important, or permissions are very important. And we've worked together with Creative Commons, I don't know if you've heard of this, to illustrate and provide the full range of Creative Commons licensing and to educate you as to what the differences is. So you can say, well, okay, after I publish, who do I want to make, how do I want to make my content available to the community? And there's, you know, different license, Creative Commons by, that gives, you provide to the user with permission to use them in a specific way. We are unique in providing the full range of these Creative Commons options. So just to reiterate, control, 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 giving you the control over pricing, of the price point of your book, the revenue, 70% of the content, 70% of the royalties, controlling the content, owning the content, you are always the owner, controlling the timing, you control the product type, is it going to be a textbook, a monograph, etc., the licensing options, can give you control of marketing, legal control, the ability to republish. Sometimes it's very important, you've made discoveries and you want to republish very quickly. So with traditional publishers, they might say, oh, sorry, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you have to wait. And giving you control of the brand. We find that ethics is very important. We've just become members of the Committee on Professional Ethics. So if there's questions about, from an ethical standpoint, about the content contained in your book, COPE has boards that will, that and they're not legally responsible for making legal decisions, but they will provide advice in terms of any ethical complaints that are made. So it's a very valuable sort of touch board to get advice, particularly if someone challenges you on the content of your book. So we've got a lot of exciting things coming up. As I said, we've got this print API that we're providing to universities. We're giving several small and medium-sized universities with the ability to create their own university press using our platform. We're getting into retail distribution. We're just working on two new exciting products, an audiobook using text-to-speech, and a book-to-digital course, allowing you to work to create a digital course with your content, so that complemented by your physical book and by an audiobook. This is not yet available. We're working on it. So what are the advantages of comparing traditional publishing to independent publishing? Well, traditional publishers, royalties, you can expect between 5 and 14%. And in principle, they'll market on your behalf. Although working for a traditional publisher, I've been in marketing allocation meetings in which we have a finite budget. We'd allocate money to this book, nothing to that book. Sometimes they die. It's like a tree dying in the forest because they've had no attention paid to them from a marketing standpoint. And in principle, there's a loss of ownership and control. So you sign over the rights to the book for a delimited period to your publisher. Independent hybrid publishers, they're typically, we charge for our services. We are a commercial organization, and we do not pay you advances. Royalties, you can expect between 60 and 80%. The perks, we believe, are flexibility, control, maintaining the ownership, we think from an economical standpoint, it's the best option. Our detractors will say, vanity press, predatory publishers, that our services aren't professional, and that's funny because traditional publishers and us, we all drink from the same well. We use the same services that the traditional publishers use. I've been at our printers, and I've seen our books come out, and the books coming out from publisher, I won't, X, Y, and Z, the same ones. The service provider that we use, MPS, very well-known, high-quality services provider, they also do it for all the traditional publishers. So there's no separation in terms of quality in that respect. They will say, oh, you don't have the status. They do not create content. Status should go to you, the authors, who are responsible for the quality and the control of the quality, not to the publisher. And that we don't have experience. Well, as I said, we've published 2.2 million books since 2002, so we know a little bit about what we're doing. What they're not going to tell you is that many of our authors have published successfully and have earned a great deal of money in the process, that we are the process of publishing with us is very quick, if that's what your intention is, and our prices are very, very low. So I urge you to take a peek at our site if you have the time, and if there's any more questions, I think I've got about maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes.
I've published, I've got plenty of articles, but I've published my first book, done reasonably well with an independent publisher. Now, what do you do, though? This accusation about vanity press and all the services, you've proved, and I know here for a fact you're right, you use the same things as traditional publishers and that, but do you actually make a sustained effort to try and, quite frankly, barrage traditional libraries and purchases in American universities in particular? North American market is what every other academic wants. Do you make an effort to try and seriously bust and break up this prejudice by actually targeting purchase librarians in the traditional areas? Because they often come from very traditional backgrounds. If they publish themselves, they have this bias against vanity and independence.
Actually, very good point, and we're working. We've started recently two committees, one in the UK and one here in the United States. And so we've got together a huge amount of librarians from universities here, and we're consulting with them. We're going to start our work in 2 weeks' time at the American Library Association conference in Chicago, when there's 25,000 of them present. And so we've got several different working groups informing them about independent publishing, the benefits, and also many of them are interested in introducing our products to their own libraries, to their own, and creating their own presses. And then this will culminate, we're going to have a discussion with them, and we've invited them to come to the Charleston conference, the library conference in Charleston in November of this year, and to focus and to produce the results of this. So yeah, and we're doing something similar in the UK. So yeah, we are trying to inform them. We are trying to get them on our side, because they realize as well, traditional publishing is not working. They're scared. They don't have the budgets anymore. For example, the country of Germany has said, we are going to cut off the traditional publishers. We can't afford them anymore. Same as in the Netherlands. So many different librarians, they're aware of this. But what they're not necessarily aware of, what are the alternative models? So you're right, we have to educate them.
How does this scale cost-wise? For example, I'm in music, so I showed you a project that has 20 books, parallel books for the same set. You talk about a $2,000 monograph. Is that $40,000 or $2,000 for the set? And by extension, I have a friend who publishes, say, I think he has around 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of music in his library. Would that end up being millions of dollars because of $2,000 per piece, or how would that scale?
Oh, no. And this is also a good question. I was actually in contact with a librarian from several Ivy League universities who I've been engaging with and have many questions. And the person from MIT said, so you mean we can print as few as 300 copies? And I said, no. When an order comes through on Monday for one copy, we'll print one. On Tuesday for 200, we'll do 200, three for 300. But you determine the price of your book. We indicate what the cost will be. And for example, you provided me an indication of your musical book, and I'm gauging that the cost to produce it in the way that you explained to me would be maybe $5-$7. Don't fix me on that. But then you determine the retail price. So if someone buys their book for 20, you get 70% of the royalty difference, and we 30%.
Yes, I understand that. I showed you a saxophone book, mm-hmm. but I have an oboe book, a saxophone book, a trumpet book. I have 20 books. So will each of those be a $2,000 monograph?
I don't know where you get 2,000.
They're entirely different books.
The price that we charge to do a hard copy, our publishing price, is $5.
Okay, the setup, though, for those 20 books, they're separate books.
Yeah, $5 for each one.
I think he's asking the difference, or is there a fixed cost to get up and running before first copy? Understanding that the per copy price might just be the print-off price.
Yeah.
We understand that. Is there a fixed cost?
There is. If you go to our website, you'll see at the top pricing, and that indicates all the prices. So For example, you determine the type of paper that you want your book to be available, the trim size, the binding, all of that, and it will indicate what the cost will be. Maybe it's $10, $20, $40. Maybe you want premium quality top binding. Maybe it's, you want to, the cost is $40. And then above that, you determine the sales price. But the, and then we charge you $5 to publish it and put it on our bookstore.
Sorry, was that answered? My question was about peer review. Yes. And what the price point is for peer review, and then where you find the peers to review. I'm in a theater background, so I'm curious.
Very good question. Of course, we don't have, the science is so broad, we don't have in our cellar tens of thousands of academics that can perform peer review. So what's absolutely essential is that our Glassleaf brand, powered by MPS, has a network around the world of all subject matter peer reviewers in the same way that traditional publishers do. So if you're publishing in a very specific range of sites, they have contracts, they have networks in specifically that area. So if and for yourself, for business, fashion sciences, fashion, then they'll have someone that they can identify in that area. And of course, science is changing. There's new subject matters coming up, and they are also creating relationships with academics in these new pioneering areas as well that can conduct peer review. And in terms of price point, it depends. We can give you a free quote. We always provide, at no obligation, a free quote. But you know, just recently I've seen someone that wanted a double-blind peer review with two reviewers, and I think it came in around $600-$700. But again, it depends how many reviewers. Do you want one, two, three, four peer reviews, single-blind, double-blind? We can give you a free estimate.
We have a couple more minutes. If you don't mind, I have a comment.
Please.
And also a question. My comment is back to that DOI issue, having dealt with that a little bit in my own past life. I thought I would just maybe clarify that my understanding is that basically, you're right. A DOI isn't itself a quality indicator. It is a persistent
identifier.
Yeah. And it is used for collecting all sorts of information. The other thing, typically you would distinguish it from a URL, and it's importantly different from a URL. A URL is simply the web address of something, where it is right now. So if somebody's creating a hyperlink, they use the URL and they can go to that place. The problem is that URLs change. They change all the time. They are not persistent. A DOI doesn't change. It doesn't matter if the ownership of the object changes. It doesn't matter if the website gets shut down and it shows up somewhere else. URLs change. DOIs do not change, which means that it is discoverable, which was where his part of that conversation started, was really about discoverability. It's discoverable for purposes of capturing usage information and other things that are quality indicators. Okay, just I thought I might be able to clarify that.
We're legally obliged to maintain these DOIs in perpetuity. So if our company was to be sold, we are obliged, the purchaser would be obliged to take over responsibility of those DOIs in perpetuity. And so it's an obligation that we have to fulfill.
And then my question goes a little bit towards that the issue of Vanity Press, and I think it would be helpful if you could clarify a little bit for this group. The question I had is, you had the slide that showed what happens after a peer review, that it either gets accepted or revised or rejected. What does that mean in the context of self-publishing? If I go out for peer review and they come back and say, that's no good, it's rejected, but I'm self-publishing, can I still publish it? Would you say then decline that piece?
You can publish it, but then you can't indicate that it's peer reviewed.
Ah, okay, so that's how you would, that's how you would manage the... Okay, you can indicate that it was accepted through a peer review.
And when something is peer reviewed, you know, we don't retain proof of it. As the owners of the content, you're responsible for this. So in principle, someone could say, you know, you have to demonstrate the proof that you have peer reviewed this. Typically, it's called like the articles of peer review. So if someone said, have you peer reviewed? Can you prove this? Yes, I can.
One more, last question. So if a book is not peer reviewed, does that play a role in the DOI as a quality factor?
No. DOI is an identification number. Yeah.
And typically, if it's not peer-reviewed, you're not going to get much academic credit for it, but you can still get it identified. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank all of you. Those were great questions.
Thank you.